Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 987. Walking the Snake with Breitbart and YouTube. This is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2017. The title of the program refers to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk. I have referenced that many times. This is published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, and the focal point for our purposes is described on the back cover of Serpent's Walk. Talking of the book, it assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, the survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. We've been talking about Serpent's Walk for quite some time. And in the last show we did, For the Record 986, we were further exploring some of the media landscape at Breitbart. That is a publication that has been described as the outlet for the, quote, alt-right, unquote. And we were looking in our first part of the discussion at Milo Yiannopoulos. Last name, by the way, Yiannopoulos. Something of a, I guess you could say, the Ernst Röhm of the alt-right crowd. Yiannopoulos is an extravagant gay dude who is part of the far-right political landscape. And because of his sexual orientation, he is able to escape a fair amount of the criticism that is generally directed at some of his compatriots. And what we looked at in part one was how Yiannopoulos and the people at Breitbart are very cagey and very conscious about avoiding buzzwords, phrases, and things that will generally draw media fire from critics as being, quote, racist, unquote, or bigoted, or what have you. At the same time as they are going out of their way to avoid overt demonstrations of the kind of bigotry that they embody, they are drawing to their cause and drawing upon the energies of many members of the alt-right, Nazis, white supremacists, and people of that ilk. One of the rising young stars in the, quote, alt-right universe, unquote, the fellow named Devin, D-E-V-I-N, Saucier, S-A-U-C-I-E-R. He may be anglicizing the pronunciation of that, the Saucier or something. But he was described by Yiannopoulos as his best friend. And so what we have with Breitbart is an overt vehicle for mainstreaming the viewpoints of the, quote, alt-right, unquote, to disaffected white youth. This is a very conscious strategy, and yet Yiannopoulos and his associates are very intelligent and very measured about how they go about doing this. They pointedly avoid certain things and are openly contemptuous of those who are not as crafty as they are in their presentation of the alt-right message. With the formidable economic power of the Mercer Industrial Empire at their disposal, legal sabers can be rattled very effectively at anyone who implies too strongly that Yiannopoulos and company are racists. They could be facing the daunting financial power of Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca Mercer. Plus, with Steve Bannon having taken leave temporarily from Breitbart, first to become Trump's campaign manager and then a very important member of the White House staff, now Bannon is back at Breitbart. The points of view that are being expressed in Breitbart are part of the political cosmology that is being embraced by and further amplified by Donald Trump and his associates. More about this relationship, and we are going to rejoin the article that we looked at in all of our show last week. It's called Alt-Right: How the Breitbart Machine Laundered Racist Hate. It's by Joseph Bernstein, Bernstein, from the BuzzFeed blog of October 5th of 2017. We're going to resume our discussion and analysis, talking about the relationship between Yiannopoulos and the other members of the Breitbart cosmology or universe, and Peter Thiel, the formidable tech giant, one of the so-called PayPal mafia, at one point the largest individual investor in Facebook, and one of the relatively few high-profile techies in the Donald Trump camp. I first discussed and warned about Peter Thiel in For the Record 718, done in July of 2010. And Peter Thiel has now emerged as a major force in the political universe, as he has been in the venture capital and tech worlds for quite some time. Resuming with the alt-right Joseph Bernstein article, Yiannopoulos also had a private relationship with the venture capitalist Peter Thiel, T-H-I-E-L, though he was more circumspect than some other correspondents. After turning down an appearance on Yiannopoulos' podcast in May of 2016, Thiel, let's just get coffee and take things from there. Thiel invited the Breitbart tech editor for dinner at his Hollywood Hills home in June, a dinner Yiannopoulos boasted of the same night to Bannon. Quote, "You two should meet. An obvious candidate for movie financing if we got external. He has effed Gawker Media founder Nick Denton and Gawker so many ways it brought a tear to my eye," unquote. They made plans to meet during the July Republican National Convention, but much of Yiannopoulos' knowledge of Peter Thiel seemed to come secondhand from other right-wing activists, as well as Curtis Yarvin, the blogger who advocates the return of feudalism under the name of Mencius, M-E-N-C-I-U-S, mold bug, one word. In an email exchange shortly after the election, Yarvin told Yiannopoulos that he had been, quote, coaching Thiel, unquote. "Peter needs guidance on politics for sure," Yiannopoulos responded. "Less than you might think," Yarvin wrote back. "I watched the election at his house. I think my hangover lasted into Tuesday. He is fully enlightened. He just plays it very carefully." By the way, in the aforementioned For the Record 718 from early July of 2010, I mentioned that Peter Thiel's background suggests very strongly that he may be underground Reich and rooted in the Bormann Capital Network.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Continuing with the BuzzFeed piece by Joseph Bernstein, and Yiannopoulos vented privately after Thiel spoke at the RNC, an opportunity the younger man had craved. "No gays rule doesn't apply to Thiel," apparently, he wrote to a prominent Republican operative in July of 2016. In addition to tech and entertainment, Yiannopoulos had hidden helpers in the liberal media against which he and Bannon fought so uncompromisingly. A long-running email group devoted to mocking stories about the social justice internet included, predictably, Yiannopoulos' friend Ann Coulter, but also Mitchell Sunderland, S-U-N-D-E-R-L-A-N-D, a senior staff writer at Broadly, that's B-R-O-A-D-L-Y, Vice's Women's Channel. According to its About page, Broadly, quote, is devoted to representing the multiplicity of women's experiences. We provide a sustained focus on the issues that matter most to women. Quote, "Please mock this fat feminist," unquote, Mitchell Sunderland wrote to Yiannopoulos in May of 2016, along with a link to an article by the New York Times columnist Lindy West, W-E-S-T, who frequently writes about fat acceptance. And while Sunderland was Broadly's managing editor, he sent a Broadly video about the Satanic Temple and abortion rights to Kim Jionet, G-I-O-N-E-T, with instructions to, quote, "do whatever with this on Breitbart. It is insane," unquote. The next day, Breitbart published an article titled "Satanic Temple Plans, Satanic Temple Joins Planned Parenthood in Pro-Abortion Crusade," unquote. In a statement to BuzzFeed News, a Vice spokesperson wrote, quote, "We are shocked and disappointed by this highly inappropriate and unprofessional conduct. We just learned about this and have begun a formal review into the matter." A day after this story was published, Vice fired Mitchell Sunderland, according to a company spokesperson. For nearly a decade, Devin, D-E-V-I-N, Saucier, S-A-U-C-I-E-R, has been establishing himself as one of the bright young things in American white nationalism. In 2008, while at Vanderbilt University, Saucier founded a chapter of the defunct white nationalist student group Youth for Western Civilization, which counts among its alumni the white nationalist leader Matthew Heimbach, H-E-I-M-B-A-C-H. Richard Spencer calls him a friend. He is associated with the Wolves of Vinland, V-I-N-L-A-N-D, a Virginia neo-pagan group that one reporter described as a white power wolf cult, one member of which pleaded guilty to setting fire to an historic black church. For the past several years, according to an observer of far-right movements, Saucier has worked as an assistant to Jared Taylor, possibly the most prominent white nationalist in America. According to emails obtained by BuzzFeed News, he edits and writes for Taylor's magazine, American Renaissance, under a pseudonym. In an October 2016 email, Milo Yiannopoulos described the 28-year-old Saucier as, quote, "my best friend," unquote. Yiannopoulos may have been exaggerating. He was asking his acquaintance, the novelist Bret Easton Ellis, for a signed copy of American Psycho as a gift for Saucier. But there is no question the men were close. After a March 2016 dinner together in Georgetown, they kept up a steady correspondence, thrilling over Brexit, approvingly sharing headlines about a Finnish far-right group called Soldiers of Odin, unquote, and making plans to attend the Wagner's Ring Cycle at the Kennedy Center. Saussure, who did not respond to numerous requests for comment, clearly illustrates the direct connection between open white nationalists and their clandestine fellow travelers at Breitbart. By the spring of 2016, Yiannopoulos had begun to use him as a sounding board, intellectual guide, and editor. On May 1st, Yiannopoulos emailed Saussure asking for readings related to a class-based affirmative action. Saussure responded with a half-dozen links on the subject, which American Renaissance often covers. On May 3rd, Saussure sent Yiannopoulos an email titled, Article Idea, How Trolls Could Win the General for Trump, unquote. Yiannopoulos forwarded the email to Bakari and wrote, Drop what you're doing and draft this for me, unquote. An article under Yiannopoulos' byline appeared the next day. Also in early May, Saussure advised Yiannopoulos and put him in touch with a source for a story about the alt-right's obsession with Taylor Swift. Saussure also seems to have had enough clout with Yiannopoulos to get him to kill a story. On May 9th, the Breitbart tech editor sent Saussure a full draft of a class-based affirmative action story. This really isn't good, Saussure wrote back, along with a complex explanation of how true class-based affirmative action would, quote, cause black enrollment at all decent colleges, quote, to be decimated, unquote. The next day, Yiannopoulos wrote back, I feel suitably admonished, unquote, with another draft. In response, after speculating that Yiannopoulos was trying to soft-pedal racial differences in intelligence, Saussure wrote, I would honestly spike this piece. The story never ran. At other times, though, Yiannopoulos' writing delighted the young white nationalist. On June 20th, Yiannopoulos sent Saussure a link to his story, Milo on Why Britain Should Leave the EU to Stop Muslim Immigration, unquote. Nice work, Saussure responded. I especially like the references to European identity and the Western greats. On June 25th, Yiannopoulos sent Saussure a copy of an analysis of Brexit, Why the Globalists Lost. Subtle truth bomb, unquote. Saussure responded via email to the sentence, Britain, like Israel and other high IQ, high-skilled economies, will thrive on its own, unquote. IQ differences among races are a fixation of American Renaissance. I'm easing everyone in gently, Yiannopoulos responded. Probably beats my bite the pillow I'm going in dry strategy. Saussure wrote back. On occasion, Yiannopoulos didn't ease his masters at Breitbart in gently enough. Frequently, Alex Marlowe's job editing him came down to rejecting anti-Semitic and racist ideas and jokes. In April of 2016, Yiannopoulos tried to secure approval for the neo-Nazi hacker Weave Allenheimer, the system administrator for the Daily Stormer, to appear on his podcast. Great provocative guest, Yiannopoulos wrote. He is one of the funniest, smartest, and most interesting people I know. Very on brand for me. Gotta think about it, Marlowe wrote back. He's a legit racist. This is a major strategic decision for this company, and as of now, I'm leaning against it, unquote, Weave never appeared on the podcast. Editing a September 2016 Yiannopoulos speech, Mueller approved the joke about shekels, but added that, quote, "You can't even flirt with okaying gas chamber tweets," unquote, asking for such a line to be removed. Marlow held a story about Twitter banning a prominent, frequently anti-Semitic and anti-black alt-right account, Ricky Vaughn, and in August of August of 2016, Bakari sent Marlow a draft of a story entitled "The Alt-Right Isn't White Supremacist, It's Western Supremacist," which Marlow held, explaining, "I don't even want to flirt with okaying Nazi memes," unquote. "We found his limit," Yiannopoulos wrote back. Indeed, a major part of Yiannopoulos' role within Breitbart was aggressively testing limits around racial and anti-Semitic discourse. Now, this last sentence again, because it really, in many ways, goes to the very core and substance of this article. "Indeed, a major part of Yiannopoulos' role within Breitbart was aggressively testing limits around racial and anti-Semitic discourse." As far as this went, his opaque organization with an organization structure and crowdsourced ideation and writing processes served Breitbart's purposes perfectly. They offered upper management a veil of plausible deniability as long as no one saw the emails BuzzFeed News obtained. In August of 2016, a Yiannopoulos staffer sent a Milo, unquote, story by Bakari directly to Bannon and Marlow for approval. I'm going to reread the last couple of sentences again, because this, again, goes right to the very core of the substance of this article. "Indeed, a major part of Yiannopoulos' role within Breitbart was aggressively testing limits around racial and anti-Semitic discourse. As far as this went, his opaque organization within an organization structure and crowdsourced ideation and writing processes served Breitbart's purposes perfectly. They offered upper management a veil of plausible deniability as long as no one saw the emails BuzzFeed News had obtained." In August of 2016, a Yiannopoulos staffer sent a Milo story by Bakari directly to Bannon and Marlow for approval. "Please don't forward chains like that showing the sausage being made," Yiannopoulos wrote back. "Everyone knows, but they don't have to be reminded every time," unquote. By Yiannopoulos' own admission, maintaining a sufficiently believable distance from overt racists and white nationalists was crucial to the machine he had helped Bannon build. As his profile rose, he attracted hordes of blazingly racist social media followers, the kind of people who harassed the black Ghostbusters actress Leslie Jones so severely on Twitter that the platform banned Yiannopoulos for encouraging them to do so. Pro tip, quote, "pro tip on handling the endless tide of 1488 scum," unquote, Curtis Yarvin, the neo-reactionary thinker, wrote to Yiannopoulos in November of 2015. Then parenthetically, 1488 is a ubiquitous white supremacist slogan. 88 stands for Heil Hitler. The 14 refers to the 14 words that were minted by David Lane, who drove the getaway car for the killers of Alan Berg. I'm again quoting here from Curtis Yarvin. "Deal with them," the 1488 crowd. "Deal with them the way some perfectly tailored, high communist New York Times reporter handles a herd of greasy anarchist hippies. Patronizing contempt. Your heart is in the right place, young lady. Now get a shower and shade those pits. The liberal doesn't purge the communist because he hates communism. He purges the communist because the communist is a public embarrassment to him. It's not that he sees enemies to the left, just that he sees losers to the left, and losers rub off. Thanks, RE1488, Yiannopoulos responded. I have been struggling with this. I need to stay, if not clean, then clean enough, unquote. Yiannopoulos had help staying clean. It came in the form of a media relations apparatus that issued immediate and vehement threats of legal action against outlets that described Yiannopoulos as a racist or a white nationalist. Milo is not a white nationalist nor a member of the alt-right, Jenny Kefauver, a senior account executive at Capitol headquarters. Breitbart's press shop wrote to the Seattle CBS affiliate after a story following the shooting of an anti-Trump protester at a Yiannopoulos speech. Milo has always denounced them, and you offer no proof that he is associated with them. Please issue a correction before we explore additional options to correct this error immediately, unquote. And then this is, obviously, this is some fairly overt rattling of legal sabers. And with the Mercer Empire, financial empire behind it, those sabers can rattle very large, very loudly indeed. Over 2016 and early 2017, Capitol HQ and often Yiannopoulos personally issued such demands against the Los Angeles Times, The Forward, Business Insider, Glamour, Fusion, USA Today, The Chicago Tribune, The Washington Post, and CNN. The resulting retractions or corrections or refusals even spawned a new category of Breitbart story. Of course, it's unlikely that any of these journalists or editors could have known about Yiannopoulos' relationship with Saussure, about his attempt to defend gas chamber jokes in Breitbart, or how he tried unsuccessfully to put Andrew Weave Auernheimer on his podcast. Nor could they have known about the night of April 2nd, 2016, which Yiannopoulos spent at the One Nostalgia Tavern in Dallas, belting out a karaoke rendition of America the Beautiful in front of a crowd of Sieg Heiling admirers, including Richard Spencer. Saussure can be seen in the video filming the performance. The same night, he and Spencer did a duet of Duran Duran's A View to a Kill in front of a beaming Yiannopoulos. And there was no way the journalists threatened with lawsuits for calling Yiannopoulos a racist could have known about his passwords. In an April 6th email, Alan Boukharis, A-L-L-U-M-B-O-K-H-A-R-I, mentioned having had access to an account of Yiannopoulos's with, quote, a password that began with the word Kristall, K-R-I-S-T-A-L-L. Kristallnacht, an infamous 1938 riot against German Jews carried out by the SA, the paramilitary organization that helped Hitler rise to power, is sometimes considered the beginning of the Holocaust. In a June 2016 email to an assistant, Yiannopoulos shared the password to his email, which began, Long Knives 1290. The night of the Long Knives was the Nazi purge of the leadership of the SA. The purge famously included Ernst Röhm, the SA's gay leader. 1290 is the year King Edward I expelled the Jews from England. Early in the morning of August 17, 2016, as news began to break that Steve Bannon would leave Breitbart to run the Trump campaign, Milo Yiannopoulos emailed the man who had turned him into a star. "Congrats, Chief," he wrote. "You mean condolences," Bannon wrote back. "I admire your sense of duty, seriously. You get it," unquote. In the months after the convention, Yiannopoulos and Bannon continued to work closely. Bannon and Marlow encouraged a barrage of stories about Yiannopoulos' late July ban from Twitter. Bannon and Yiannopoulos worked to distance themselves from Charles Johnson's plans to sue Twitter. "Charles is PR poison," Yiannopoulos wrote. "Charles is well-intentioned, but he is whack," unquote. Bannon responded. And the two went back and forth over how hard to hit Paul Ryan in an August story defending the alt-right. "Only the headline mocks him correct," Bannon wrote. "We never actually say he is a cook in the body of the piece," unquote. But once Bannon left Breitbart, his email correspondence with Yiannopoulos dried up, with a few exceptions. On August 25th, after Hillary Clinton's alt-right speech, Yiannopoulos emailed Bannon, "I've never laughed so hard," unquote. Still, as the campaign progressed into the fall, there were clues that Bannon continued to run aspects of Breitbart and guide the career of his burgeoning alt-right star. I give this last sentence again because it is important. Still, as the campaign progressed into the fall, there were clues that Bannon continued to run aspects of Breitbart and guide the career of his burgeoning alt-right star. On September 1st, Bannon forwarded Yiannopoulos a story about a new Rutgers speech code. Yiannopoulos forwarded it to Bakari and asked for a story. On the 3rd, Bannon emailed to tell Yiannopoulos he was, quote, trying to set up DJT interview. The interview with Trump never happened. And on September 11th, Bannon introduced Yiannopoulos over email to the digital strategist and Trump supporter Oz, O-Z, Sultan, S-U-L-T-A-N, and instructed the men to meet. There were also signs that Bannon was using his proximity to the Republican nominee to promote the culture war pet causes that he and Yiannopoulos shared. On October 13th, Saussure emailed Yiannopoulos a tweet from the white nationalist leader Nathan D'Amigo, or D'Amigo, D-A-M-I-G-O, who went on to punch a woman in the face at a Berkeley rally in April of this year and led marchers in Charlottesville. Quote, "At real Donald Trump just said he would protect free speech on college campus," unquote. He used phrases extremely close to what I say. Bannon is feeding him, Yiannopoulos responded. Yet by the early days of the Trump presidency, and as the harder and more explicitly bigoted elements within the alt-right fought to reclaim the term, Bannon had clearly established a formal distance from Yiannopoulos. On February 14th, Yiannopoulos, who months earlier had worked hand-in-glove with Bannon, asked their mutual PR rep for help in reaching him. Quote, "Here is the book manuscript to be kept confidential, of course, still hoping for a Bannon or Don Jr. or Ivanka endorsement," unquote. The next week, video appeared in which Yiannopoulos appeared to condone pedophilia. He resigned from Breitbart under pressure 2 days later, but not before his attorney beseeched Sobov and Marlow to keep him. Quote, "We implore you not to discard this rising star over a 13-month-old video that we all know does not reflect his true views," the lawyer wrote. Bannon, ensconced in the chaotic Trump White House, didn't comment, nor did he reach out to Yiannopoulos on his main email. But the machine wasn't broken, just running quietly. And it wouldn't jettison such a valuable component altogether, even after seeming to endorse pedophilia. After firing Yiannopoulos, Marlowe accompanied him to the Mercers' Palm Beach home to discuss a new venture, Milo Incorporated. On February 27th, not quite 2 weeks after the scandal erupted, Yiannopoulos received an email from a woman who described herself as Robert Mercer's accountant, unquote. "We will be sending a wire payment today," she wrote. Later that day, in an email to the accountant and Robert Mercer, Yiannopoulos personally thanked his patron. And as Yiannopoulos prepared to publish his book, he stayed close enough to Rebecca Mercer to ask her by text for a recommendation when he needed a periodontist in New York. Since Bannon left the White House, there have been signs that Bannon and Yiannopoulos may be collaborating again. On August 18th, Yiannopoulos posted to Instagram a black-and-white photo of Bannon with the caption, "Winter is coming," unquote. Though he ultimately didn't show, Bannon was originally scheduled to speak at Yiannopoulos' Free Speech Week at UC Berkeley. The event, which was supposed to feature an all-star lineup of far-right personalities, was canceled last month, reportedly after the student group sponsoring it had failed to fill out necessary paperwork. And Yiannopoulos has told those close to him that he expects to be back at Breitbart soon. Steve Bannon's actions are often analyzed through the lens of his professed ideology, that of an anti-Islam, anti-immigrant, and anti-globalist crusader bent on destroying prevailing liberal ideas about immigration, diversity, and economics. To be sure, much of that comes through in the documents obtained by BuzzFeed News. The camp of the Saints Bannon is there, demanding Yiannopoulos change refugee to migrant in a February 2016 story, speaking of the hashtag War for the West. Still, it is less often that we think about Bannon simply as a media executive in charge of a private company. And a successful media executive produces content to expand audience size. The Breitbart alt-right machine embodied by Milo Yiannopoulos may read most clearly in that context. It was a brilliant audience expansion machine financed by billionaires, designed to draw in people disgusted by some combination of identity politics, Muslim and Hispanic immigration, and the idea of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama in the White House. And if expanding that audience meant involving white nationalists and neo-Nazis, their participation could always be laundered to hide their contributions. Again, this last sentence, because it is in many ways the thesis statement of this article. Speaking of Bannon and Breitbart, it was a brilliant audience expansion machine financed by billionaires, designed to draw in people disgusted by some combination of identity politics, Muslim and Hispanic immigration, and the idea of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama in the White House. And if expanding that audience meant involving white nationalists and neo-Nazis, their participation could always be laundered to hide their contributions. Indeed, walking the snake behind a facade.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
We're also going to talk about how the mainstreaming of white nationalist, white supremacist, Nazi views, whatever one wants to call them, quote, alt-right, unquote, they have been very skillful at using YouTube. From Right Wing Watch of October of 2017, an article by Jared Holt, H-O-L-T, white supremacy figured out how to become YouTube famous. And it reads in part, YouTube is home to a seemingly endless variety of videos that reach all kinds of viewers and is creeping up on TV itself as the most watched video platform in the U.S. But as John Herman documented in the New York Times Magazine last month, political punditry on YouTube is vastly dominated by right-wing talkers. Some of the site's most notable right-wing political stars include the always camera-ready men and women at the InfoWars studio, frequently shirtless 4chan news Stix Hexenhammer 666, and elaborate cosplay cartoon character Mr. Dapperton, unquote. Although these figures differ vastly in format and tone, their messages are aligned exclusively toward the hard, uncompromising right, and have been increasingly influenced by their even more extremist counterparts on YouTube. Shorenstein Center on Media Fellow Zach Alexey, E-L-E-X-Y, noted in a case study of YouTube commentator Black Pigeon Speaks that in the same way that, quote, liberals, scholars, and pundits have failed to give talk radio, which is almost wholly conservative, its due, these same observers stand to miss a new platform that so far is also dominated by the right wing. Far-right YouTube personalities are largely aware that they are at the epicenter of political talk on the platform and openly gloat about their dominance. As a platform, YouTube has served as an alternative media ecosystem apart from the mainstream where any person can contribute to national conversation and reach thousands of people overnight. But the right's overt domination of the platform, in addition to political forums on Reddit and 4chan, has created an environment where white nationalists and right-wing extremists can easily inject hateful rhetoric and conspiracy theories into national political discourse by positioning themselves alongside less overtly hateful, rising right-wing media personalities. These extremists role-play as modern-day shock jock radio hosts as they insert their sexist, racist, bigoted rhetoric, which they excuse by saying they are trying to trigger, unquote, liberals and fight for free speech, unquote, into the existing stream of right-wing commentary on YouTube. By successfully identifying how right-wing e-celebrities operate and collaborate in the YouTube ecosystem, white nationalists and white supremacists have cracked the code to achieving YouTube success and getting their ideas validated by more popular internet figures, and therefore have emboldened the political base that they represent and recruited new audiences as a result. The punditry faction of YouTube, much like cable news, thrives on collaboration and guest appearances on other pundits' channels. These right-wing YouTube commentators believe that by bolstering one another, they can break through fake news, mainstream media narratives, and spread their own flavor of political analysis. The most extreme of these commentators will identify YouTube pundits slightly closer to center-right than them and appear on their programs to share their viewpoints. They then use this access to a larger platform to recruit more people to their own pages where they espouse extremist views with even less restraint. In practice, this means that some of the most popular right-wing social media pundits have validated white supremacists and ethno-nationalist voices by joining these extremists on their platforms and allowing them to grow their audiences. As a result, those voices have quickly recruited a radicalized following and felt emboldened to take their ideologies offline. The nation saw this dynamic play out with tragic results earlier this year when alt-right activists who had organized online converged on Charlottesville for a Unite the Right rally that ended in the death of a counter-protester. On YouTube, major right-wing internet personalities such as self-described New Right journalist and social media personality Mike Cernovich, CERNOVICH, and Lauren Southern, a former reporter for Rebel Media, a news site that had acted as an alt-right safe space, validate lesser-known extremists by promoting them with their platforms, which reach millions of people every month, and routinely earn exposure from mainstream press. Although these two are now attempting to break away from their prior affiliations with the alt-right, they have used their YouTube platforms to validate and share ideas with openly alt-right pundits like Tara McCarthy, who believes a globalist agenda is underway to undermine white people. In May, Cernovich appeared on right-wing YouTuber Brittany Pettibone's Virtue of the West podcast, which is dedicated to discussing the white nationalist ideology of a virtuous Western world under attack by a liberal agenda. Cernovich's appearance effectively endorsed the legitimacy of Pettibone and her former co-host McCarthy to Cernovich's much larger audience and exposed potential new fans to the duo who openly express much more extremist views than Cernovich does. This kind of trickle-down effect is not limited to Cernovich. Many other prominent right-wing social media personalities have appeared on programs like Virtue of the West, unquote. For example, video blogger Tarl P.A.R.L. Warwick, W.A.R.W.Y.C.K., who was heralded on 4chan and promoted by major video bloggers like Paul Joseph Watson, has guided his audience to openly alt-right media platforms such as Red Ice. Digital pundit Carl Benjamin, best known as Sargon of Akkad, has exposed his regular audience of hundreds of thousands of viewers to white nationalists and their hateful ideologies. This trickle-down exposure effect is a characteristic of all media, but the lack of a gatekeeper on social media has allowed unchecked extremists like McCarthy to harness the power granted by voices such as Cernovich to elevate openly white supremacist alt-right ideologies. Soon after McCarthy scored an interview with Cernovich, she treated her followers to a conversation with Andrew Anglin and Greg Johnson of the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer. McCarthy's interview with Anglin and Johnson was later removed from YouTube and re-uploaded off-site. Cernovich's appearance on Virtue of the West is not an isolated event. Every day all across YouTube, popular pundits with large audiences and connections to those in power are engaging with, promoting, and validating extremist YouTube personalities who seek to radicalize their audiences and promote extreme right-wing politics. YouTube has been criticized for designing algorithms that are, as The Guardian reported, quote, drawing viewers into ever more extreme content, recommending a succession of videos that can quickly take them into dark corners of the internet, and has been toying with remedies that can effectively isolate extremist and terroristic content without censoring speech on the site. In early August, YouTube announced it would no longer allow videos on its site that were flagged, quote, for controversial religious or supremacist content to earn ad revenue and rack up views from the platform's recommended videos feature. Since that announcement, conspiracy theorists, alt-right activists, and new-right internet pundits have expressed outrage. videos these social media pundits created to meet YouTube's criteria for extremism have been placed in a limited state, unquote, where they exist in a purgatory space without advertising or video recommendations, meaning only a direct link will bring viewers to the video and that the content creator earns no revenue. YouTube's action served to accomplish two things. It removed financial incentives for these personalities to cater to extremists, and it helped create a rabbit hole effect in which the site's algorithms recommended increasingly more extremist content to otherwise mainstream right-wing audiences and resulted in right-wing extremist YouTube stars receiving otherwise unearned exposure. Leaders of the right-wing political YouTube universe criticized the policy in a myriad of ways, even likening it to Nazism. We will have more about this article in our show next week. The point being here that as with Breitbart, in which Milo Yiannopoulos was drawing on a wellspring of a more or less openly white supremacist or Nazi or anti-Semitic characters, and yet very cunningly crafting the content to avoid any of the overt, well, not overt dog whistles, but any of the overt manifestations of those ideologies. So, too, with regard to YouTube, we are seeing a kind of networking that brings many of these creatures together. More about this next week.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
I'm going to conclude this program with the same musical selection by James McMurtry that I used to close the last program, and it discusses not only the types of people who can be won over by YouTube or by Breitbart. I also want to dedicate this to the Republican Party and to those members of the so-called progressive sector who sought to undermine Hillary Clinton because she wasn't pure enough for their ideologies.
Chair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner. Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. In the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus or hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Like the ones we made before, except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin, or the shape of their eyes, or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they've never known need. The sh** don't stink and the kids won't bleed. The kids won't bleed in the damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. In the alley and trash in the street, gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
That again by James McMurtry. We can't make it here anymore. we will continue with our analysis about Serpent's Walk and some of the contemporary media outlets that are realizing that doctrine, and that in our next show. This concludes, for the record, 987, Walking the Snake with Breitbart and YouTube. This is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.